Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
All right, here's what I want to do. This will be our final segment. Kind of a lightning round of, you know, tough issues that apologists have to handle. Yeah. I don't want to necessarily do it to get – I want your answers, obviously, or at least a suggestion answer. But the whole idea here is to unpack the thinking process, the weighing process, the how I value, you know, the idea that something really can break in that's divine into the world versus the cynicism and of science and things like that. So are you okay for, like, if I just, like, throw out a tough – okay. Joseph Smith and the interface with magic – yeah. Folk magic, was that an essential part of his training? Is, you know, how open would you be for that history to come in a little closer, you know, needing to bring Emma to get the plates and the whole
worldview? I actually wrote some things about that early on when the Salamander letter was a big deal and so on. And first of all, I argued that the term magic was problematic, that you really can't distinguish clearly between folk religion and magic. They blend and blur, and any attempt to define magic that doesn't include somebody's religion seems always to fail. And I actually spent some time on that. I haven't done it in years, but I wrote a little bit about it. I even spent time for a couple of months at Princeton in an NEH seminar on the concept of magic in the ancient world. And the conclusion, the upshot of that seminar, which had anthropologists and classicists and everything in it, these were all academic, you know, PhDs, was that we could not come up with a definition of magic that made any sense, that applied to everything that's been called magic, but didn't include religion of some kind or another.
So I guess my bigger question is, this isn't fitting behavior for a prophet of God. We've already talked about the definition of prophet being, you know, too high of a standard. Yeah. Is there any smoking gun, or is there any, like, real something you know is a fact that just sort of is still stuck in your craw about that, or is this one completely gone? And what was the process of saying, I accept?
I think the issue for me is completely gone. But I think of biblical precedents. For example, Joseph and his divining cup. And prophets of the Old Testament seem to be involved in things that we would now call magic. Abraham and walking between the severed parts of the birds and all that. This is an old divinatory ritual. So if you want to have a nice, neat demarcation, boy, out goes the Bible, too. And so I don't see any reason to do that. Okay. I don't think there's anything in Joseph's career that turns me off and says he couldn't have been a prophet. And I do think that an openness to some kind of otherworldly gift or influence is maybe one of the things that opened him up to receiving divine revelation. Mm-hmm. One of the things that people don't deal with is the question. A lot of the people who were around him actually believed he could find things.
Oh, sure.
You know, that and apparently clear. He did. Right. So what do you make of that? Yeah. I'll tell you one experience I had. This is a really weird one, and I've been ridiculed when I went public with it, which I haven't done in years.
Now,
but I'm going to do it again. This is a chance. Years ago, my brother, I went into the family construction business, and I walked into the office, and my brother said, come here for just a minute. And he handed me a rod. Just like a metal hanger rod, but you know, long and straight, and then turned down at a 90-degree angle at the end. And he said, hold this in your hand. See, I think there were two of them.
And then where they cross is water.
And he said, hold these in your hand, and then walk across the floor here. And I walked across, and they're very distinctly crossed at a certain point. I thought, okay, that's weird. I'm going to do it again. And they crossed every time at the same point. I said, okay, what is it? And he said, well, there's a water pipe under there. Okay. I said, okay, I get it. It's a metal water pipe. There's some sort of magnetic thing going on. He said, no, it's a clay water pipe.
Oh, clay. Wow.
Yeah. I said, all right. This is not fitting my scientific worldview. All day long, I was working in the office that day, and all day long, whenever anybody would come in, I'd hand them the rods and make them walk around. And they crossed at the same time, with one exception, the mechanic. But he had huge hands. I think he was holding them too tightly. But for everybody else, all day long, they crossed at the same point. I don't know what to make of that. And then I began asking friends of mine, and I've asked others up here. I know engineers who use divining rods. They don't admit it publicly, but they'll tell me. They use it to avoid cutting a water line when they're doing work, and others. I was sitting by a field in St. Louis and saw a guy from the Department of Water and Power get out of his truck, look around, get out divining rods, walk across the field and do it. I know people who witch for water wells in down by Yuma. Yeah. I don't know what to make of it, but I don't laugh at it because... Yeah. I swear, it happened to me.
Well, I was on the crew that built the Spanish Oaks golf course, and we did it.
Did you?
Yeah. So that one doesn't bother me either, but yeah.
One of my neighbors is a landscape architect, and he says, you know, they laugh at me for using divining rods. He says, well, I'll tell you this. I have never cut a water line. All the guys who laugh at me have.
That's interesting. That's great. All right. Okay, so... I'll just go right to polyandry. Joseph Smith's marrying more than one woman. So, again, the answer is important, but I want more of the thinking process to come out on.
That's a difficult issue, and that's one of the things that is most problematic in Joseph's life, I think, is the idea of polyandry. Now, I think that there's an article in this new book that I mentioned by Newell Bringhurst and Craig Foster that to my mind shed some really interesting light on that in every case there was reason to believe that these women were separated from their husbands for one reason or another, or that the marriages were not consummated. You know, you can debate this all day long, but I'm wanting to say is I think there may be factors in this that we don't quite know about where it might help us to understand the practice a little more if we knew more. And it may be that we can't know more. The records are gone. The testimonies are silenced. You know, that's it. It's going to look bad. Mm-hmm. And so you have to decide, do I trust this guy or not? But I am relieved to think there are some things coming forth in the last little while that may actually help with this issue, mm-hmm. I think, quite nicely in some ways.
Okay, so the fallacy of anachronism.
Yeah,
we all know that is like taking today's standards, applying them to the 19th century or even earlier, and saying there's no possible definition of a prophet.
Yeah,
even the 1-inch thick definition of prophet can't handle certain things. And so polyandry, a lot of people look at it. I interviewed a couple of guys who became Mormons atheists, and one guy says that was it. That was my one thing, and so. With you saying new things are coming out, is this just, if you're in that mode, shelf? Is that what you say? Or
yeah, I would say so. I think that, I know some people can't. I mean, I know.
Is it a personality type? Is it a sin?
No, I don't say it's sin in every case. It might be. In some cases, it might be just personality type. I mean, there's no calculus for determining who will or won't be able to stand an issue like that being on the shelf, because every one of us is absolutely unique in terms of personal history, psychology, quirks, evidentiary knowledge, evidentiary gaps, you know,
that's
strength
of the
conviction here, weakness of the conviction, you know. So I just can't predict. But for me, I'm willing to say from everything I can tell, Joseph was a good guy. Again, not flawless.
Right.
We'll never make that claim. But on the other hand, I hear some Mormons say, well, of course, he was seriously flawed, but still a prophet. And I think, no, I don't even go with the seriously flawed. Mm. I think a good guy, basically. Mm. But flawed, as we all are. Mm. But with that in mind, I'm willing to cut him a little slack. I'm willing to believe there's an explanation, and I'm happy that now there are some explanations that I think are starting to come out that make some sense. Now, whether they'll stand up to review, I don't know.
Yeah.
But so far, they look pretty good to
me. So if he just plain out and out became a predator of sort on other people's wives?
I would find that very, very, that very troubling, yeah.
But you just...
Yeah.
So you don't know that isn't the case, but you doubt it because of the rest.
I don't think it's true. Yeah, I don't think it's true because of the rest and also because of some of what I know about... You know, and I read about some of these marriages that he did where supposedly he's driven by lust, right, according to the critics. He's just, it's libido that's got him going. But you read about some of his marriages, and they go like this, you know. So-and-so brings his sister by, performs a wedding in Joseph's office. Joseph afterward thanks them, shakes her hand, and says, thank you very much. And she leaves, and he goes back to work. I mean, great passion there.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, fairly sears the screen. To me, it's like He's forming kinship ties.
Right.
And I'm struck recently by the failure to find descendants of Joseph.
Right.
Now, people say, are you hoping that he never had sex with any of these women? No, I don't think that's what I'm hoping. It wouldn't bother me particularly if he did. But the image that I've often had presented by critics is it's just virtually one nonstop orgy. Well, how come there are no kids yet? Mm-hmm. I mean, good grief. We know he could have kids. That suggests to me that sex was a more minor part, the element of this story, than the critics want to let on. And that in some cases we know he was sealed to fairly elderly women by the standards of the day. Yeah. I don't believe that was about sex at all.
Yeah, it sounds like you're in a combination of Richard Bushman's claim that it was more about kinship,
right.
as well as Todd Compton's introduction to his Sacred Loneliness, that it was about exaltation. You know.
And did
and
he sometimes,
some women would choose Joseph because of the theology. Whether we're defending that theology or not, it was at least made sense within that.
I think
world
it's related to the old idea of adoption too, which was phased out when we had our new vision under Wilford Woodruff of the genealogical society and sealing back to Adam and all that sort of thing. But in the old days, you know, you'd be sealed to church leaders. They couldn't go back very far.
Yeah.
And so you wanted to be sealed to a church leader. That was your chance at exaltation.
Yeah.
Now we understand that was wrong. And so we don't do that kind of thing anymore. But as they were stumbling forward in the concept of sealing.
So you're okay the fact that they were acting out of a bad a bad worldview, or at least
I think they may
not
have,
bad. But.
They may have understood the idea of sealing and not have understood fully how it was supposed to work.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right, let me give you a couple more just again to sort of think. All right, Dan, let's do another one. This is a tough one. The Book of Abraham, what we know about it as far as the actual papyrus and whatnot versus this quite elaborate vision or whatever it is that Joseph Smith got. How do you handle that? And this is one of those where I think a lot of the church and the scholars know a lot more than ever gets communicated from the pulpit or in CES or anything. So,
well,
what's your approach?
I wrote a piece for The Ensign years ago, which I intended to be a kind of consensus statement, sort of a rapid-fire enunciation or elaboration of enumeration is the word I'm looking for, points where I thought the Book of Abraham gets things right about the ancient world that it does in quite remarkable ways. And so one of my first responses to the Book of Abraham issue would be, let's bracket for a second the question of its relationship to the papyri. Let's look at the text itself. Mm-hmm. Does it look ancient? Does it contain authentically ancient materials or things that could be argued to be? And my answer would be yes, resoundingly yes. I think it's really, really interesting. I love the Book of Abraham for precisely that. It feels really old to me. Mm-hmm. And there's specific points that I could point to, have pointed to.
So as somebody who's immersed themselves in that world, it feels, it tastes old.
It does.
It tastes
it tastes
like a fit.
Yeah.
You can't convey that to critics.
No, you can't.
Yeah, but
it's subjective. It's like it's like my response when I say I read Joseph Smith's journal entries. To me, they read like the entries of an honest, sincere man.
Yeah.
I've had other people read them and say, nah, he's a fraud.
Yeah.
He's you know, lying for posterity.
Right.
Like, well, okay, I can't convince you, but boy, it does. If I have any sense of what an honest man looks like, this is one.
Okay. So no relationship with papyri.
Yeah, we'll bracket
treat it
that
on
for
itself,
a second, but you just
then,
treat
then
it on
there's
its
some
own.
Good flavors there.
There are a lot of things. The plurality of gods, the council of gods. These are all, we know, authentically ancient things. Even things like Olishem turns out to be a real name from approximately the right area. I've looked at Arabic texts, for example, about Abraham's vision of the heavens, which isn't in the Bible, but it's in the Book of Abraham. Mm-hmm. And oddly enough, they even use the same word, kawkab, or kawkabim. In Arabic, it's kawkab, kawakib, different plural, but it's the same root, which is unusual a little bit in Arabic. But it's the same root as used in the Book of Abraham account. I mean, that's not a big weighty argument, but it just struck me as odd that they use this unusual, more Hebraic term when they're talking about Abraham's vision of the throne of God and seeing the heavens and all that sort of thing. At point after point after point, I can allude to things in ancient texts that tell a similar story, make a similar point, view the world the same way. I published an article a few years ago with Bill Hamlin and John Gee, where we argued that the astronomical scheme in the Book of Abraham is most plausibly interpreted as a geocentric astronomy, not a heliocentric one, which doesn't come out of Joseph Smith's environment. Mm. But it's not done in such an overt way that it looks like somebody's faking it for us. You have to read it really carefully, and then you realize, good grief. Now, of course we're not interpreting it correctly, because it's written from the standpoint of a geocentric universe, mm-hmm. which is what I'd expect from the Egyptians, right. not from Joseph. Mm-hmm. There are a number of things like that. So mm-hmm. I say the text itself is impressive. Let's not get totally mired in the question of how the text was derived from the papyri.
And his interpretations of the facsimiles.
They make sense on their own. In fact, the four canopic jars under the lion couch did sometimes symbolize the four quarters of the earth. In fact, the alligator underneath, or the crocodile, I remember a certain critic years ago published something, and he made fun of Joseph because Joseph said it's the idolatrous god of Pharaoh. Well, what does he think it is? It's Sobek the crocodile god, who particularly in the Fayum, the oasis to the west of the Nile Valley, which was where the capital was during the time of Abraham, the capital city in Greek times was called Crocodilopolis because it was infested with crocodiles.
Mm, interesting.
The symbol of the pharaoh during that time was a crocodile. His patron god was Sobek, the crocodile god. And I even at one point took a picture. I had to bribe a guard to do this in the museum in Luxor to show, I think it was Amenophis IV, and he is standing next to Sobek, and Sobek has his arm around him like, we're the team, you know, larger-than-life statues. It cost me a little bit to get that picture. I sent it to accompany my article for the Ensign, and they lost the slide.
Wow.
So I'm going to have to go back and bribe another guard to get that picture.
Wow, so it completely disappeared day before digital.
But you know, it was a perfect illustration of that point, that it was not ridiculous for Joseph to identify that as the idolatrous god of Pharaoh. In fact, I thought, what yokel farm boy would have even thought of that?
Right.
But he's precisely right. It's not laughable. It's correct.
So somehow he has hits.
Yeah.
There's hits of ancient.
Yeah.
There's some possibilities here. So why give me the connection between the papyrus itself and the revelatory process. Yeah. Is that?
Now, I'll be honest. I don't know exactly what the relationship is. It is possible. It's always struck me as possible that Joseph's looking at the papyri and getting... He's not translating in the sense I would translate.
Right.
He hasn't got a lexicon, laboriously.
But apparently he was working on one.
Well, yeah.
Is that then complicated?
There's another story there.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's an entirely different thing, unrelated in some ways to the Egyptian language.
Okay.
I think it's a sort of Masonic cipher. Okay. Will Scriver did some work on that recently, and I'm hoping it'll be published eventually, because I think some of it's really, really, really interesting. Mm. I think he may have solved the question of the Kirtland Egyptian papers. And they go in a direction that I hadn't thought of. Mm. So, but it's pretty clear to me Joseph's getting this by revelation, as he did
so
with
like
the Book of Mormon.
It's like the hat.
Yeah, so I'm thinking to myself, how does he know what the relationship is between what he's getting and what's on the text? Actually, he doesn't know. He can't know because he doesn't read any Egyptian. It's just gibberish on a papyrus to him. So he could think he's getting it from the papyrus, and he's actually just being inspired to seek knowledge and getting it by revelation. I don't necessarily conclude that. I think he maybe was getting it by revelation, but it was on the papyrus, but not on the papyrus that we have.
So the one found in the fire?
Yeah, I'm convinced that we don't have most of the papyrus. I know some people have criticized that, but I think the evidence runs the other way. And I'm hoping we'll be publishing something on that in the foreseeable future where we argue for the original length of the papyrus scrolls and that what Joseph had was only a small percentage of, or what we have, rather, I should say, is only a small percent of what Joseph had. So it is possible he did get it off a lost portion of the scroll. But the fact is, right now, it does not, if you translate the scrolls that we have, they don't yield the Book of Abraham. That's right. Absolutely clear.
Yeah.
No way around that.
So if somebody were to come to you, I'm really troubled about the Book of Abraham, you'd say, well, are you open to the idea of revelation and that there may have been a physical tool that sent him into the a dissociated realm or something where he got ideas
something like
came
that.
Through him?
I'm not saying it didn't come from the papyri.
But you're saying...
But it wouldn't bother me particularly if it didn't, and Joseph thought it did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But you wouldn't want to, so you'd be more likely to think that in the Book of Abraham than the association between the Book of Mormon plates and what came out of his head. You'd want to claim historical factual lineup there a little bit more.
But even there, I don't rule out the possibility that, again, Joseph's getting it by revelation. Now, some people say, well, that means he's... Peterson says, I've had this response before, Peterson now is giving up on translation. No, I've always believed he was getting it by revelation. He couldn't read Reformed Egyptian or Egyptian. He never claimed he could. So. It's always
it's not
been by
translation
revelation.
That way, yeah.
Yeah. But, it's not translation.
The Joseph Smith translation of the Bible is not translation.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And he used the word translation in a different sense. Yeah. Not, by the way, a totally idiosyncratic one, because it can be used in broad senses, like the translation of relics from Alexandria to Vienna to Venice. The skull, the relics of St. Mark were translated from there to there. You know, it means conveying something.
Okay.
However it's conveyed.
Right.
It doesn't always have to be with a grammar book and a lexicon. Okay.
All right. So thankful that's helpful. Because the temple's so big, that one supposedly, you know, I'm saying endowment, this is a necessary sacrament, you know, ordinance for exaltation. Mm-hmm. Clearly, it wasn't a pure... you know, gift from God. It came through Masonic tools and whatnot. What's your basic approach to that? And especially some of the extra theology that has, you know, I don't know, how strong is the, these are signs and tokens you have to flash to angels and all that stuff when they were clearly Masonic in origins to begin with. So how do you wrestle, or let's just pretend this time that I'm, you know, my heart's right as a person who's coming to you saying, you know, the temple is just like this separate entity to me that I really need a good answer.
Well, I would offer up several possibilities, and none of which I'm perfectly settled on. I would say, first of all, that I'm really impressed with the temple. Again, there are elements of the temple that I feel are, they have the feel of antiquity to me. Bill Hamlin and I twice have taught a seminar here on campus on celestial ascent. To me, the temple is a model of celestial ascent. You start off at the base of the cosmic mountain where the waters of life flow. You climb up to the presence of the gods, so on and so forth. There are certain passwords and so on you need to know to get up past the sentinels up to that place. You see it even in Dante's Purgatorio and Paradiso. But you find it everywhere. It's in China. It's in Egypt. It's in Islamic lore. It's everywhere. It's astonishing how widespread it is. So to me, the temple as an ascension ritual makes sense in antiquity. Certain specific elements of the temple make sense. Baptism for the dead I have no problem with. There's lots of ancient evidence for that in Christianity from my point of view. Other things, even the use of hand clasps, for example. Gosh, you find them all over. I mean, in every funeral stela in ancient Greece, there's dexiosis, the taking of someone by the hand. There are... in Ravenna, you can see the mosaics there where God reaches through a cloud to pull the saint into heaven, that sort of thing. I see a lot of ancient material there.
So you're taking it away from masonry only and just saying it feels archetypally true culture after culture. Would you then go, therefore, originated in the same spot, and this is sort of a...
Masonry, as we know it, seems to have been created relatively late. But out of elements, in some cases, that are older. I mean, I can find you compass and square imagery on medieval tombs in the Middle East. Todd Compton wrote a piece ages ago in grad school on the use of that sort of thing in classical Greek material. Mm-hmm. It's very old. It's older than I thought it was.
So would you go old because it archetypally works, or old because it's of a diffusion from
ancient? I'm sort of a diffusionist.
Ancient, so you're more of a...
But do I deny a relationship between the LDS temple and masonry? No. I think Joseph may have used masonry the way he used the Bible for the JST, the Joseph Smith translation, that it sort of provides him a framework, but he changes it. The myth, if you will, that's used in the endowment is fundamentally different from the standard Masonic myth.
Right.
The symbols in some cases are the same or close, but they're revalued, they're transvalued. They bear totally different meaning than they do in Masonic.
I agree that that's true.
Yeah.
So how do you handle the, this is so important. How do you handle the separation between the ritual that obviously evolves in picked up pieces versus what the endowment is.
Yeah. Well, I see a difference between the endowment and the presentation of the endowment.
Okay, good.
The presentation has changed over the years. The endowment, and I would have to be somewhere else before I'd start describing what I think exactly that is, but the endowment, I think, remains fundamentally the same. The presentation changes. We know it's changed. Okay. It's gone through film. It's gone, you know, in different configurations of rooms and so on and so forth. It's been longer. Things have been dropped. Things have been changed, reworded. So that's obviously not just handed down from Sinai engraved in stone. There are even some things that have been taken out of the temple endowment that I sort of regret the loss of because, dang, I had really good ancient parallels to them.
Oh, interesting.
And now, not only I never could really use them, but now there's a dwindling audience who would even understand them if I did. So, you know, that's sort of in an odd way exasperating.
Yeah, I was a pre-1990 endowee.
Yeah.
And
symbolically, I thought they were interesting. They said something. But, but the fact is, as people change, as culture changes, symbols change meaning, and sometimes they begin to symbolize something they weren't intended to, and at that point they have to be changed. They become dead or misleading or dangerous symbols. So I think I understand why the changes were made, but still. But my argument would be there is something distinctly true in the temple, and I think distinctly ancient.
And it would be this ascension...
That and other parts.
Teaching,
I think the initiatory ordinances... I mean, there are parallels to those in ancient temples as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and I see parallels even when I walk into a Catholic church and see people taking holy water and then anointing themselves and so on.
Sure.
I see parallels in the great houses of ancient Greece, if you read the Homeric poems... when a visitor comes to one of the great houses, he's been tramping through the dust. He arrives, the servants are sent to wash him, clothe him, you know, anoint him, all that sort of thing. I think a lot of this is just the hospitality ritual of coming into a Lord's great house.
Wow, very cool.
So.
Good. Well, I think that gives a hint. So, okay, so Dan, I want to, here was my goal today. A human face on this often misunderstood guy. I think you've come across as the person who's enjoyable, who's brilliant, who all the things that I know. So I think we've done a good job there. So I'm just pleased for this. I hope that there's been a meta message here of don't rush to conclusion because you've really articulated. Hold on just a minute here. Don't define yourself out of the church because of expectations or whatnot. All right. What I would love to give you a chance to do, and if you don't want to do it, we can cut this. what are the pillars of your testimony? If someone were to say to you, were to give you 5 minutes only, why are you a Mormon? I would love to close with that.
Okay. I haven't really thought this through, but I'll try to come up with something. I suppose I'm a Mormon. There are a lot of reasons. One, I've already mentioned the vision of the grand sweep of the plan of salvation just spoke to me. It just resonated with me, to use a perfectly trite word. But it did. I mean, it hit me immediately, and I thought, how have I never heard this before? I never picked this up in primary classes or Sunday school classes. I must have heard all of the elements, but I hadn't seen the sweep of it. And when I did, it moved me, and it rang true to me. On a much lower level, I would say one of the things that keeps me in the church intellectually is this, and I haven't really articulated this yet. I have tried, I think seriously and honestly, to formulate a comprehensive counter-explanation for all the elements I see as arguing for the truthfulness of Joseph Smith's claims.
Interesting.
I can't do it. I can see a plausible counter-explanation for this part or that part. Sometimes the counter-explanations are mutually contradictory. They don't account for everything. And so, to me, the most coherent way to put it all together is to say, God really did intervene here. Something happened here that cannot be explained in any naturalistic way that I can think of. I'm just not persuaded by the critics. I've tried to read them sympathetically. They'll deny that I had an open mind, but I've tried. I think I really have, and I'm not persuaded. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that's remarkable because if this really was the product of a fairly shallow, uneducated yokel, it ought to be transparently false. And I don't see it as transparently false. I see it as pretty strong. And I don't say all issues are resolved, but a lot of issues are. And there's a lot of evidence that, to me, points to the authenticity of the claims. I haven't really mentioned life in the community.
Please.
But that's an important part of it to me. And I say this as someone who in some ways doesn't like Mormon culture very much.
Okay.
Every once in a while I'm flipping the radio around and I hear some Mormon pop music station. It's excruciating. It's like fingers on a chalkboard to me. Eternity always rhymes with destiny and, you know, things like that.
Oh, God.
It's so horrible. I can't stand it. Now, I like some things. I like the history of the church. I am moved by the pioneer stories and, you know, the handcart companies and
it doesn't make it the one and only true church.
No, but it's moving and satisfying.
As a historical arc.
And I see the presence of God in the lives of people in the church. And a couple of years ago, I saw a YouTube video or something of saints coming from Cameroon to the temple in Nigeria. I don't know if you've seen that. It's remarkable. It takes them 4 or 5 days to get there through mud, you know, up to the top of the Toyota they're in and all that sort of thing. You have to get out and pull it through the mud. And the people who put this together were missionaries there, and they played Come Come Ye Saints to the background. And I thought, that's right. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. We think those days are over. They're not in Cameroon. They're not in a lot of places in the world. And I'm moved by that. I am moved by these stories. I'm comfortable with being a part of this people. And another thing, I'm comfortable with being part of a ward. I like my ward. There are people in it I would never choose to be my friends. It's good for me to be in that ward. It was good for me to be a bishop. And I'll tell you, I don't want to insult anybody, but I was assigned to a ward. Here I teach at BYU, and my life is academics. You know, I'm really into this stuff. I was assigned to a pretty poor ward on the outskirts of UVU. Some of them were students. A lot of them were not. A lot of them were working pretty low-level jobs. And they're not going to be captains of industry or nuclear physicists. I found that a lot of the tools that I would normally use in interacting with people were just useless. I remember talking with my executive secretary at one point saying, I'm going back to Washington, D.C. And he says, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I think I'm going to be sitting at the table with Condoleezza Rice, which turned out not to be true. She didn't come. I was really upset because I was going to be sitting right next to her.
Right.
Well, he said, I think I've heard that name. Who is she?
Yeah.
And I thought, we live in different universes. Yeah. But the point was, I kept thinking to myself, this is good for me. This is really good for me because it's stretching me in ways I would not have chosen to be stretched.
Yeah.
I would not have chosen to be a bishop. I would not have chosen to spend hours and hours every night, you know, dealing with the mentally ill, with incredible hypochondriacs, chronic liars, you know, and a lot of good people too. I don't want to say they were all crackpots, but and difficult, intractable issues and dysfunctional families and all that sort of thing. But it was really good for me. It was a great experience, especially in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think things like that are good. It's good for me. Years ago, I was sent down to the welfare cannery. There were a bunch of us trying to work one of the canning machines, and we couldn't figure out how to do it. We were so incompetent. And we gradually realized we didn't know each other, but one of them had a PhD in mathematics.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a Middle Eastern PhD. Another one, I think, was a philosopher or something, and totally useless.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is really good for all of us to be here.
Yeah.
I had a friend once in Southern California who objected to going to welfare farms and so on. He said, I'm a lawyer. I could pay people to do that. This is not a good use of my time. And I thought, no, you need to go to the welfare farm.
Right.
You should be down on your knees repairing chicken coops and things like that because it's good for your soul.
Yeah.
I like that element of the church, too. I really, really do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just find Mormonism an intellectually satisfying, stimulating way to view the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's rich to me. Now, I know some people feel stifled by it. I've always found that incomprehensible. When I first began to understand what the church was about, going back to that experience with Truman Madsen, it was like the universe opened up.
Yeah.
For me, I was as excited as I could be, and I still am.
Yeah, and I felt that in my own life too. And it's, you know, I wrote a dissertation on the stuff that I love that does stretch beyond just it. And this is always uncomfortable because you've shared a testimony here. I'm priming you rich is one thing, the one and only true. Or is there a way that you assert that, or that you distance yourself from that? Yeah. Because I know that's a hang-up for a lot of people, the exclusionary sort of feel of it.
Well, I have to face that issue a lot, because professionally I deal with another religion, Islam. And and I do socially, too. I mean, hardly a week goes by where I'm not entertaining Muslims on campus or lecturing to Muslims somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I've done the same thing to a much lesser degree with Jews and Catholics and so on and so forth. And, you know, there is no question that there are good people in these other faiths, that that they're in many cases better than we are, and they do things that we don't do as well. I've always loved, and everyone knows this now, Christian Stendhal's three rules of dealing with other religions. Mm-hmm. I've loved the principle of holy envy. Mm-hmm. I do envy what some people do. I envy Orthodox Jews, their way of handling the Sabbath. I grew up thinking, how ridiculous, you know, 300 steps on the Sabbath, how silly. That's not it at all. We weren't understanding them. They love the Sabbath, and I envy them the way they do it. I envy Muslims their devotion to Scripture in some ways, their devotion to prayer. I envy the seriousness that Catholics give to the idea of priesthood. I had the experience in Cairo years ago of coming out of the Dominican monastery where I studied for 6 months one-on-one with a famous Dominican monk there who was an expert on Islamic philosophy, of all things. And he got a huge kick out of the fact, by the way, that I was a Mormon. He used to teach at UCLA sometimes. He knew the temple, and he was constantly pestering me about Mormonism, and we had a great relationship. Once I came out of the monastery, and there were all these peasant women gathered around wanting a blessing from me. Father, Father, please give us a blessing. And I said, no, you're wrong. You know, the fathers are in there. I'll go get one for you. Mm-hmm. But then I thought, as I was walking away, you know, I'm the guy with the priesthood here. They don't, from my point of view. I ought to take this more seriously. They do take it seriously. Yeah. I'm so casual, I almost forgot I had it.
Yeah.
You know, now, I wasn't going to fake it and pretend to be a Catholic priest and give them a blessing or anything. But there are a lot of things that I envy about other people, and yet I do stick to the notion that this is the one true church. Now, what I mean by that, though, it's hard to explain this. I've said I'm almost a universalist. I believe that nobody who seriously tried to get at the truth is going to be deprived of all the full blessings. God will decide how to do that. I almost lean toward Karl Rahner's idea of the anonymous Catholics, you know, Catholic or Christian by intent, that sort of thing. I'd like my friends to become Latter-day Saints, but if they don't, I'm not too worried, provided I think they're really trying to find the truth and to live according to the best they know. I think they'll be fine. And so I have a missionary urge, but I also am not afraid that God is going to thrust them into hell. Just because they failed to perceive that, hey, Joseph Smith was telling the truth. They'll get it someday. And in the meantime, we've got to learn a lot from them. So on the one hand, I'm an exclusivist, but on the other hand, I'm very much an inclusivist. I believe in reading. I'm serious about wanting to read the books of other religious traditions because I can learn things from them. Mm-hmm. I love Thomas A. Kempis. I love Al-Ghazali. I love some of these works because they teach me a lot. I've used arguments from Al-Ghazali in Mormon apologetic materials. I've actually, just as an experiment, quoted Al-Ghazali in sacrament meeting without identifying him.
Yeah, that's fun.
And things like that.
And it sounded like scripture.
Yeah,
and it just,
truth is truth, you know? Yeah. And so I believe that God spoke through Joseph Smith. I believe there's something very unique about that speaking and that
unique
act
throughout all of history.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
But one of my favorite people of the 20th century is John Paul II, one of the greatest men of the century. I admire him inordinately. I have a picture of him on my office wall. I admire the current Pope. I have a picture of Albert Schweitzer on my wall because I admire him enormously. And yeah, I see God working through all of these people, and I can learn something from all of them, and they'll be fine.
So would you choose to not testify about the one and only true church as a way of not offending or whatever? In other words,
I won't do it to Muslims.
Yeah.
Because I don't even feel we should be converting Muslims at this stage.
Oh, I see.
you know, I mean, some Muslims do convert. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But we don't go after them. We don't target Muslims. I will bear testimony to that. But I will also bear testimony that if you don't become a Latter-day Saint, then be really good at what your tradition mm-hmm. is. Live up to the best you've got.
Mm-hmm. Teach us some things.
Yeah. And I like a line from the Quran where the Quran says that God created us in many faiths so that we would vie with one another in good works.
Right.
I love the play Nathan the Wise, you know, where basically there's a test to see which is the true religion. And in the end, it turns out the true religion is the one that makes... They're all competing to show they're better than the other guy, doing better works. Well, that's the test. They think it's something else, extrinsic.
To be truly a compassionate person or...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the test.
So I'm an unreconstructed Mormon exclusivist in that way, but I'm a universalist Mormon exclusivist who thinks that the Lord is... God is a loving father. And I think there are some people who will exclude themselves from his love. Some of them will choose to do so. Some of them will just... They prefer evil. I don't know what you can do with those, except maybe educate them over the course of the eternities. I hope even they'll come around. But I really can't believe that the Lord's going to say at the end of this all, ha, gotcha. You know, you failed to read the right book that would have persuaded you.
Well, and everything you've said is within Mormonism. You're deep within, you know, you're in the safe ground.
Yeah.
But I know that sometimes when you get to testimony and there's a sense of one and only truth, it can hurt people in their heart. And I probably shouldn't even have taken us down that road. Anything else that you're excited about that you'd want to, you know, proclaim from the housetops that comes out of Mormonism or...
I think one of the things I'd like to get across is that I view Mormonism as a religious humanism, a theistic humanism. I really value humanism. I have a high opinion of human beings, and so I'm sympathetic even to non-religious humanists. I think that they have something important to say. Classical humanism of the Greeks and so on. I don't view humans as worms. So depraved that they can't do anything good. Mm-hmm. I think one of the great things about Mormonism is that we are children of God and that we're God's in embryo. This gives a really high status to humans. We have infinite worth. We're worth more than most of the things around us, most of the things we devote ourselves to. Mm-hmm. It's unworthy of us, but we do it. We devote ourselves to things that are worth less than we are. I think that's a great message to get out. And I suppose one of the things that's on my mind right now with the current flurry of attention to Mormonism, you know, in the play on Broadway and the two presidential candidates and so on, we're being depicted in many circles as adherents of this really weird religion, these quirky little doctrines and so on. I say, well, you know, forget the quirky little doctrines. Some of them are kind of misstated anyway, or they're not essential, or they've been taken out of context. Or just if you understood the whole bit of Mormonism, they would make more sense to you. Anybody can make a belief look weird if you take it out of its proper setting. I mean, even a flower can look silly in certain locations. Take it out of the flower bed. Yeah. But what I want to say to them is, and what I think Mormons sometimes forget, is this is a really expansive view. It is very open and sympathetic. We can believe, and we do. We have official statements to the effect that there are there's the divine spirit is working out there beyond our church. We're not the narrow-minded sectarians that you may think we are. We're not fundamentalist Protestants who happen to have an extra book and maybe an extra wife.
Right.
You know, it's a bigger vision than that.
Yeah.
It's really quite interesting if you get into it. You don't maybe have to buy it. If you could see it, at least from my vantage point, it's a big, big worldview. And when I'm mocked as this narrow-minded little provincial, and I think, you got me so wrong. First of all, I've traveled probably more than you have. You know, there's a fellow online now who's ridiculing me as if my world is Provo. And I think, I don't even live in Provo. You know, I didn't even grow up in Utah. I've lived around the world, I've traveled on every continent and so on. I'm multilingual, and who's the provincial here? But that's a personal subsidiary point. The point is, Mormonism itself is bigger than that.
Right.
And I object to it when critics try to paint us as a narrow-minded little fundamentalist sect, and I really object to it when Mormons try to do it.
Right.
I don't like it from either side. That's why I object to this, some of this young earth creationist stuff that I'm hearing recently. No, that's not us.
Yeah.
This is an expansive, big vision, not a narrow-minded little anti-intellectual, you know, thing that's hostile to culture and hunkered down on itself. So that's what I love about the church in some ways, is that it, to my mind, it's so big and it's so liberating.
Yeah, and it is a wonderful, empowering view. Dan, thank you for being on Mormon Stories. I really appreciate the time that you've given us and the generosity of your spirit. And again, I've known you as a friend here for at least 8 or 10 years, and now I'm even knowing you as a person who I resonate with. Somehow or other, we have the same Mormonism in many ways. You've certainly read a lot more, and you've certainly dealt with the specific issues more than me, but I really appreciate all that you've brought today. So thank you. I know our listeners will really enjoy.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it. It's been fun.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive. Do this and joy, your hearts will swell. Journey's through, happy day.